I came from Bristol in the West Country of England, and I lived there until I was 18 when I had a place at the Royal Academy of Music in London. So when I was 18 I moved to London and I was at the Academy for 4 years studying the violin, and then after that I gave up music, and having also studied the piano to some extent but not as much as the violin, I went to work in a bank. And I was in the bank for 18 years, and then I moved over here to Mount Mellery Abbey, where I've been ever since. So that's 31 years now I've been at Mount Mellery Abbey.
So 31 years you've lived here, yes. with the monks and with the priests here. What kind of, like, is it a monastic life? Is it very similar to how they live? Have you just kind of fallen in with how they live and follow that way of life?
Yes, I don't exactly live with the monks. I live in one of their rooms, which is on the premises, because it's a huge premises. But I wouldn't actually be living in the part that the monks are living in. But I think one could only live here if one embraced, to some extent, the monastic way of life. I have been going to the church, obviously, to play, because that's my job, playing the organ for the monks, for them to chant. That was the reason I came here originally, and I'm still doing that. But that leaves a lot of time, obviously, to read and reflect, as the monks do. I wouldn't be reading and reflecting on the same sort of books, probably, as the monks, because they'd be much better educated in religion and so on than I would be. I've found my own way, I suppose, following up different paths of books and ways of thinking. I don't go out, really. I can borrow a car any time I want to, but it's only for little bits of shopping down the road. I don't go anywhere. It's not a life that you could live if you were looking to be socialising at all, because obviously it's a population which is moving all the time in the guest house, and I would never be socialising with the monks, who are mostly silent. So one has to be able to occupy oneself. And I found that my background in practising the violin for very long hours when I was at school and then subsequently at the Royal Academy of Music has taught me how to occupy myself and to order my time.
Did you come here just for a break or a short break and intending to go back to London?
No.
Or did you know when you came here that you were turning your back on it, essentially?
Absolutely. When I was living in London and working in the bank, I did some other jobs in hotels and so on, really just to sort of get experience of how other people lived, having had no such experience when I was practicing so hard. I mean, I was working literally from 7 o'clock in the morning until 11 o'clock at night when I was at school, trying to get in 4 hours violin practice as well as studying for O's and A levels. And then when I was at the academy, anybody who was going to try and do anything in the music world would expect to do between 6 and 8 hours practice solitary on their own every day except Sunday. So you learn to sort of order your time. But when I went into the bank, I saw it as my next step, if you like, in trying to learn how to socialise and make up some of the lost time.
Did you feel like you were forcing yourself to do it?
In many ways, yes, I think so. It was a learning thing, and most people learn to socialise when they're adolescents. And ask any of the musicians that I would have been studying with, and we all had to sort of let go of that to a large extent. In order to get up our standard, because that's the only time we would have been paid to practice. That was how we looked at it. So anyway, when I went into the bank, I was lucky enough to get in with, first of all, a family from Cork, and then with their friends as well. And I socialised a lot with the people of Ireland and enjoyed that very much. And they became my friends. And one year, they invited me over to Cork to stay in their family home for a holiday. And they had grown up, actually, in a building next to the place where one of the monks here in Mount Mellery had spent his boyhood. So they had a friend in Mount Mellery Abbey. So they said one day, well, let's go down to Mount Millery Abbey to see this person. And I drove down with them. I didn't really know what to expect. I was almost expecting a ruin, I suppose, because I just really didn't have any sort of preconception. I'd never seen a picture of the place. So we came down here, and they said, well, we booked in for lunch. And I thought, well, that's unusual. So we had our lunch. And then in the afternoon, after the prayers, which we went into the church for the prayers, then he came out to meet them, and I was introduced as well. And that was my first introduction, if you like, to Mount Millery Abbey. We had a wonderful afternoon, and we walked around the beautiful countryside here a bit, up to the cross and so on. And as I left, I somehow felt I was leaving my heart behind. It was a strange thing. I almost dreaded going back to London after that, because I'd seen such beautiful silence and stillness, and it was like coming home. Yet I hadn't seen much of the Abbey, really. I suppose only the church and the guest rooms and walking around here. And so the contact we kept up, and every time I came over to stay with these friends, each year we came over and we'd come down to see this monk, and they learnt that I played the violin, and they said, would I bring my violin down one day and play to them? So we just have a convivial afternoon. They'd end up singing anyway, and I'd be playing, and it was just so perfect, so beautiful. But word had got around, I suppose, inside. I don't really know how that happened. I had a phone call one day in the bank from this monk who said that I think I should warn you that the abbot is going to be phoning you this evening to ask you whether you'd come over and play the organ for the monks. And I was shattered because, I mean, I thought maybe it was just for one day. And I said, but I don't really play the organ. I can play the keyboard. And it turned out anyway that it was for good. They wanted somebody. They had a monk here who was playing the organ for the office, and because they'd gone beyond the plain chant at that stage, and the plain chant they can do unaccompanied, but this was a more modern office where they'd gone into the vernacular, into English, and the music had been written by a nun in Glencairn, but it required an accompaniment, not a complicated accompaniment, just to give them the note, basically, to keep giving them the notes all the way through. Mm. So I was very surprised about this. And
was there any part of you that thought, maybe this isn't a good idea? Or did it just feel like the sea opened up ahead of you and this was your path and this was where you were meant to be?
No, but it's interesting that you gave the metaphor of the sea there, because I thought it would all probably just fall down again. I thought, well, maybe I wouldn't be good enough on the keyboard anyway. It seemed such a strange and it just seemed unreal. Of course, some of me thought, yes, what a wonderful opportunity. But then, I mean, I had my job in the bank, and I was buying a flat, and my family, obviously, was all in England. And it seemed unreal, I would have to say. And I just sort of thought, I'd go along with things and see how, you know, see what happened. But I hadn't decided I'd do it. And so he said, well, next time you come over, I'll introduce you to the abbot, and you can talk about it. And so I came over. And the abbot had said that he would like me to play to a monk in Glenstall who was a musician there, who'd written music and everything. So I thought, here we go. So anyway, I played to him. And I was here for a week, and I couldn't make up my mind, really, until the very last day. And then as I was leaving, and strangely enough, it was the Feast of Pentecost. And I thought, well, if I'm ever going to be able to be given the grace to do this and to say yes, then it will be on the Feast of Pentecost. And it was. It was at the Mass. And that particular monk that I knew was saying the Mass, and I can say that I knelt down after receiving communion, and I thought, yes, I'm going to say yes. And so I did so. And they said, well, now you have to sort of wrap everything up over in England. So I had to tell everybody and give in my notice. And there was no going back at that stage, because I gave in my notice finally in the bank and put the flat on the market. And
because some people might look at that decision as, if you're turning your back on what a lot of people would deem normal, and I say that in inverted commas, normal life, it's because you're trying to escape something. Mm. So did people say, what's wrong with you, Susan? Why are you running away? Why are you escaping? Did you get that kind of reaction?
I didn't, but don't forget, you're talking about England, and I think probably, especially London, people wouldn't be that concerned even about what what one's motives were. You know, I think in Ireland people are very, they talk from the heart. I'm not saying the English haven't got hearts, but I'm saying that we would be much more reticent, much more reserved. So even my family didn't say that. They didn't even say, have you considered it? But I said that you talked about the sea just now, because which is an interesting metaphor, because the monk that I knew here never tried to persuade me to do it. He was just trying to help me to sort of facilitating, if you like, my decision. But he never said, I never even asked him, should I or shouldn't I? I knew he wouldn't answer that one. It had to be my decision. But I remember that the last night before the Feast of Pentecost, I did in the end, I said, well, what do you think I ought to do? And he took a deep sigh and he said, there's something in Julius Caesar by Shakespeare which says that if you don't take the wave, then you're running the risk of being left in the shallows. And he said, I would say that maybe to you.
That's very powerful.
Wasn't it just? Yeah. He had a way always of saying things which were powerful like that, but without, you know, of course you must do it, never say anything like that, but it was I was just standing out there on the forecourt and it was very powerful, certainly. Yes.
Did you ever regret it?
Never. Coming over, I said nobody was to come to the airport to see me off, because I didn't, that, you know, we could say anything with my family before I left, but not at the airport. That never seems to be the right thing. And I must admit, my heart was sinking when I got onto the plane with all my bags. And I didn't know what to expect here, being as I didn't know if I could drive a car here. So I'd sort of packed up mountains of things that I thought I might need so that I wouldn't have to bother anybody to get me even to a shop. I didn't realise there was a supermarket even in Capoquin. I never noticed it driving through, you know, from Cork. So yes, my heart sank to some extent. And it was traumatic when I sort of started unpacking my things in the afternoon. But then by the evening, I had known that it was, you know, that this was for good, and that I was glad, not just, you know, trying to put up with the homesickness, that I was glad I was here. There have been ups and downs of all kinds. I mean, the monk that we knew died after only 7 years of me being here. They're very kind to me, the monks, obviously, but I don't live in their pockets by any means. So therefore, to cope with that sort of thing, one is alone, and they would be hard times. But I've never, ever regretted it. I can honestly say not once have I ever regretted it.
Can you tell me what your normal day would be like?
When I first came, a couple of years, I alternated with the other monk who was playing the organ. So it's a heavy day of prayer, if you like, because vigils then began at 4 o'clock in the morning until 5. I can't remember the times of the other ones, but that would be followed by Lourdes around 7, I would imagine, followed by straight on by Mass. And then Terce was at 10 o'clock, I think, then. Sext would be around lunchtime. Noon would be after a one-hour siesta at about 2:30. Vespers then would be around 6 o'clock, and Compline would be at 8 o'clock. So he and I, we tried several ways of sort of doing it, whether it was one day on or one day off, or one office on and one office off. It got a bit confusing, really. But that's the way it was until, I think, he cut his hand. This was the reason they took me on originally, which amused me. They said, well, yes, he's playing, that's fine, but he could fall off a ladder, and then we'd have nobody. I was thinking, well, the poor man. But I think he did. It was Easter time, I remember now. And I came through after playing vigils. So that would have been about 5 o'clock in the morning. And he's still alive, this man. And he met me at the door as I came through into the guest house. And his hand was dripping blood. And he said, you're going to have to play the whole of Easter. I can't play. So from then on, I played more. And I know for several years I was playing all of those offices, which is heavy. I mean, they go in to sing, and that's their lives. And they manage it, you know, as do the nuns. Now, I managed it fine. Yes, I did at that time. And I felt it was a privilege to be able to sort of keep them going, if you like, as much as the organ was able to. But then I wasn't required to play vigils anymore. After about 15 years They decided they were going to recite vigils apart from the hymn because of falling numbers, basically. You know, I mean, to sing at 4 o'clock in the morning is no joke. And they also put vigils on until to 4:30. And so I wasn't required for vigils. I then started doing pretty much what I do now, which is play Lourdes at 7, Mass at 7:45. They have another monk who, not the one who cut his hand, who's very old, who play the little hours, as we call them. And then I play for Vespers in the evening. But my day, I wanted to, you spoke about being monastic. I wouldn't say I was monastic, but I do think that if you're going to live here, you have to use the benefit of being here, you know. And to me, it would be maybe more than, well, not vocal prayer, because I never sing the office, obviously I play it. And they would be very much into sort of the reading and the prayer of the church. For me, it's the silence and the stillness, which I have always loved since I was a child, for some reason. I could play around with the children, my brother and sister, but to just be still and silent. I can remember times in our garden at home where just standing still and thinking, there's, I didn't know what I was listening for, but to just listen to the silence. And that's what this place really offers to people who are not monks.
But, you know, the society we live in now, it's not really conducive to that kind of peace and silence. And when you look at how society is now, do you feel sorry for people that they don't have that kind of opportunity to be peaceful and silent?
I think that people would benefit greatly from making that time. I think it's possible. I was talking to a nephew of mine when I was over in England for the first time for 3 years because of COVID, and he's a busy teacher, and he says he begins every day with 10 minutes meditation. Now, I don't think he'd be particularly religious, but he said just to recollect himself, and that if he hasn't got that, he can't face into it very well. And living in London, working in a busy high street bank, even there, it is possible to find the peace you have inside you, I think, and to find a place of peace. I mean, I used to go down to the church at lunchtime and just sit. I used to fall asleep, I think, sometimes I was being so busy all through the morning, knowing what I had to face when I went back. But but you wouldn't find silence probably anywhere in London. There's always the roar of the traffic. But to just be still is possible anywhere. And I think that it's probably something which is possible for anyone, wherever they are, if they really want it. And living here, I mean, we have it made, certainly, and people who visit here find the same thing. I still get up and I'm not bragging here, but I find it's a way of enjoying the silence and the stillness. I get up at 3:30. And I don't go out of my room until I go down to play for Lourdes at 7:15 I go down. But to just experience the silence, and especially now with the birds waking up early and you watch the sun come up and so on, it's a wonderful grounding sense of peace and a transcendent experience, I would have to say, you know.
Do you ever get lonely here?
No. I have a very supportive brother and sister whom I can talk to on the phone. And you find when people's families grow up, you grow closer back to them again, I think. You know, they used to come over with their young families and we used to have a great time for a week in the summer. But now their families have grown up. I find that we're getting to know each other on a different level again, which is it's lovely, it's wonderful. So if ever I needed support or help, I know that they'd be there, albeit on the telephone. But I can't say I've never been a lonely sort of person, no. And of course God is always there, whether people think that or not, he is. And if you're listening there in the silence, things get better just by sitting still and silently.
Well, you've written two books, but one of them is the most beautiful book, and the idea behind it I adore. It's called Where His Feet Pass, and it's based on a year in the life of this relatively short path here in Mellery, but you really intrinsically kind of analysed it and studied it for a year and showed it for every day of the year, for every season. What was your idea behind that? Just to take a small patch of the earth and really study it for a year?
Well, photography is my great hobby. I really enjoy it. And it's my reason for going out walking. And I began, I suppose it was when digital photography came in, and it was the whole thing sort of opened up for me. I decided I was going to do the four seasons in photographic form of this beautiful place, because things are so transient here, the weather can change in 2 seconds, and people had come here before and taken good photographs, but it's so chancy because they could come and they could get sort of 4 days of mist. And the mist is also beautiful, so I wanted to capture everything, and I knew, because I know the place so well, I knew which would be the first trees to burst into flower and where different little things were. So I did four seasonal books, first of all, just of photographs with hardly any text. And then so I thought, well, I've taken photographs of every corner of the place, but you find that it evolves again. There's always something more to take. I don't like taking pictures of people, I must admit. I think it puts them on the spot, and I'm happier just out on my own with the camera. It's just the way I am, you know. So one day after Mass, this is how the first book came out, that Where His Feet Pass, I didn't have the camera with me, but it was such a beautiful morning, and it would have been about, I suppose, 8:30 in the morning. I went down through the public cemetery, and this is where this my path, as I call it now, is. And it's just a straight farmland path at the top of a field. It's not up hills or anything sort of particularly scenic. But it was just lovely to be down there, and the birds were singing. And I looked down, and something had caught my eye. It was a sort of a flash of light. And I looked down, and it was just a little red campion flower. And I think that's what it was, anyway. And I thought, that water and that light at that time and that flower, which would probably be dead tomorrow, it just struck me, the beauty of God and how marvellous things that are around that we just take for granted. So I thought, well, I'll go up for the camera anyway, because the plant's there now, and see what the picture is like. So I came down and took the picture, and then I looked around, and there were several other beautiful little wildflowers that I probably never noticed on this path. And so I like setting myself little targets. And so I thought, well, if I take a picture of every flower that comes on this path, then it would be something worth having just as a private project for me. So I started doing that, which meant I was going down onto the path every day, because they don't last for long. And it depends on the lighting, all sorts of different things were sort of showing themselves to me then, which I'd only ever walked along that path just sort of quickly before on my way somewhere else, as it were, up the mountain or whatever. So I had all the pictures of the flowers, as I thought, for the spring. And then I took a picture of a flower, and there was this little insect who was sitting on the corner of the leaf looking up at me. I thought he was looking up at me. When I saw the picture, I'm sure he was. Because insects are things that fly around and they get in the way, but they're not things that if you see a nice dog, you say, well, you'd relate to it. But not an insect, I didn't think. But there was this picture of it turned out to be a dung fly, actually. So I called him Dermot. And I thought, well, if he can do that, then surely we can get this with other ones. And then I started looking at the insects, and I was amazed at the diversity of the insects. And with a good camera, close up, you have to be careful how you do it, because they fly off very easily. But if you start from a bit further away and get closer and closer, then eventually you'll get something that probably you can see everything, and their eyes are, they do look at you, I'm sure they do. So they all started to become characters for me, and I was going down there to see what I could see, and then the bees all came out, and bumblebees were so beautiful. And I was finding a new insect almost every day. And I was delighted with the pictures when I got back.
And those insects then you developed into a beautiful children's book called Brother Bee.
Yeah, well, after we'd finished the big one on the path, Dermot the Dungfly kind of took over at that stage. And I thought, he's such a character. And then the idea of Brother Bee came into my head. Because we had a Brother Bee here. People called him that for short. It was his full name was Bonaventure Boniface, I think it was one of them. But anyway, I saw Brother Bee, B-double-E. We could put a cowl on him. And his little antennae would be sticking up, and he'd with the big sleeves and so on, and it would become a children's book. And I suppose it was during the lockdown, and sort of madness had taken me over by that time, and so I wrote this children's story surrounding the insects on the path, Brother Bee was the messenger on behalf of the other insects, and when they got into trouble, he would fly up into the church and sit in front of the tabernacle and tell Lord Jesus all about their troubles, and Lord Jesus would then tell them the answer to their problems, and then he'd fly back down and they'd have a meeting. And then, like, obviously you couldn't take photographs of that sort of thing, so then I got out my paint box and I painted the pictures. And it turned into a children's book.
It's beautifully illustrated. And anyone who's looking to purchase the books, they can email shop@mountmellery.ie, that's MTMELLERAY.ie, or by phone on 058-54404. Susan, just to finish up, you've been here now 31 years, as you said. Is this where you'll see out your days? I know that you still have many more to come, but is this it for you? Is this where you want to be?
Yes, this is it. This is till death us do part. Yeah. Yes, this is where I want to live and to die. Definitely, yes.